This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. There is not a quorum here yet, but we're going to begin anyway. Today we're going to do an overview of groundwater issues. I think very helpful, informative things that we were going to have a presentation on about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and we had all the folks coming here, and then session went long that day, and all their preparation, everything did not get presented that day. And so because they had put together this and put a lot of effort into it, and we have a lot to learn from this, we decided to postpone it till now. We also will have 4 confirmations to hear after that, but the first hour and a half we're going to have with the presentation on groundwater, both understanding the resources and managing them. And I think this should be, I mean, I've seen some of the documents that are in our packets, and it's a very informative thing. So with that, I'd like to, and by the way, I did invite some House members who were interested in water issues, and Representative Peter Fisher is joining us. And I think this could be very helpful to us. And what we'll just do is go through it, and if people have questions along the way, members, please catch my attention. And with that, Jason Mokel from Department of Natural Resources, you're going to introduce it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate the invitation to be here today. My colleagues and I are going to present a lot of information fairly quickly. Somebody has likened it to trying to drink from a fire hose, so if we're going too fast, do please interrupt so we can clarify, because that's what we're all here to do, is just to make sure we're understanding information. We had one of our speakers, Mr. Jim Seal, exercise better judgment, not driving from southwestern Minnesota today. He called to tell me that he had snow and ice and he wasn't going to drive, and I said that was a good choice as his manager to be safe. So I'm going to pinch hit that presentation, and it'll be a little rougher than it would have been for him, but we'll still try to convey the information the best we can. So with that, I want to start right into this and simply describe the problem that we're here to talk about. The problem
Mr. Mokel, I'm going to just interrupt to let members know all of these presentations have PowerPoints in our packets, and I think they're in order of the way they're going to be presented. So please go ahead.
Yep, I believe that's correct. Thank you. And I should have said Jason Mokel, Department of Natural Resources, for the record, Division of Ecological and Water Resources. The problem, simply stated, is that there are places in Minnesota where we are not achieving sustainability of our groundwater resources, and we are currently making decisions with a lack of information. And you can think about these as 2 key risks. Do we overuse the water, and do we contaminate it? And the presentations that you're going to hear today are going to talk about what we know about contamination and what we know about overuse. So I want to set some context. First of all, the importance of groundwater specifically, but also water in general, to our drinking water. Over 5 million Minnesotans rely on some source of water for our drinking water. Municipal systems, 2.7 million people rely on groundwater. Private wells, we have 1.2 million people relying on groundwater. And then about 1.3 million of us rely on some sort of surface water. And even those surface water sources are often relying on groundwater as a backup in case that surface water source is either contaminated or not available due to drought conditions. And some of the stories you'll hear today will illustrate some of these relationships. Bottom line is 75% of us rely on groundwater for our drinking water. I do want to provide just a brief preview here about the drought, and that is that, as most people know, starting last August, we got very little precip. We did make up a bit of that this winter, unfortunately, because frost had set into most of our soils. A lot of the snow melt that we've had this spring has run off. That's fine and great for streams and lakes and rivers, wetlands, but we're not getting the same recharge that we would typically get into our groundwater. Precip patterns projected this week might help with some of the recharge, at least in the southern half of the state, because we believe soil frost is starting to come out. We'll get some recharge. But we are in a dry condition, and this was particularly felt hard in southwestern Minnesota, and some of the examples that I'll talk about later were really, the impacts were stronger because of the drought than we'd otherwise would have seen. There's 2 recent news stories that I wanted to highlight for you that kind of illustrate why this is such a strategically important issue for the state of Minnesota. One was a story last December in the Duluth News Tribune, and I thought the quote from Mrs. McKay here, whose well had gone dry, well, she said, "I didn't think it was possible to run out of water in the land of 10,000 lakes. We've never had a problem before in the 14 years they've lived there, and several of her neighbors' wells had gone dry." Now, this is in the center of this circle is a picture. This is where Mrs. McKay's residence is, where her well is. And you see all those light blue and blue dots. Those are wells nearby her home. But the point I want to illustrate is if you look at this, that arrow points to 1988. There were just over 30 wells in that vicinity, that 1.5 mile vicinity of her home, back in 1988 when we experienced the biggest drought that we've experienced on record in modern times. Since that time, we've got 160 wells now in that particular area. And this kind of illustrates the problem. Little by little, one year after year after year after year, we continue to add pressure on our groundwater resource. And at some point then, when we get drought conditions, we realize, oh, we maybe have surpassed some thresholds of capacity. This just illustrates that very nicely. The other major article headline that I wanted to bring forward is paying the price of crop fertilizer at the faucet. And this was a story that depicted, you know, the challenges we face with nitrate in our groundwater and our drinking water supply. The folks from the Department of Agriculture are going to share the information that they've been collecting with you on all that. So where are these water supplies? These red triangles that you're looking at illustrate where communities who rely on surface water are located. Two of the biggest ones are Minneapolis and St. Paul, Duluth, and then several others, the Grand Rapids area in particular, the Arrowhead, because of the limited availability of groundwater, tends to rely more heavily on surface water. This map, all these blue dots, represent community groundwater supplies. As you can see, this number far outweighs the number that are on surface water. It illustrates that we are very heavily dependent on groundwater. There are over 670 communities that rely on groundwater to meet their water supply needs. And then when you pepper the state with all the private wells, you pretty much see that this is an issue that is relevant to everybody in Minnesota, no matter where you are. 250,000 private wells throughout the state. The challenging part about this is that we have a very complex geology. You're going to learn more about that from Mr. Setterholm. This is a map that provides a very simplified portrayal of our groundwater resources. Basically, the areas in the southeastern part of the state, highlighted in that sort of gold color. Groundwater tends to be more plentiful here. We've got multiple bedrock aquifers. Rather than if you look at the southwestern part of the state, that darker green and all the way up through the Red River Valley, much more clay soils. We don't have the bedrock aquifers. The aquifers that we do have don't typically yield as good a quality of water as in the metropolitan and the southeast, and also not as much. The central sands part of the state is typically pretty good for groundwater, but it's basically sandy aquifers and then crystalline bedrock underneath. And then in the northeast, we get into the very hard rock. Groundwater is generally not very available. So I want to bring this home in terms of sustainability a little bit, and I'm going to speak specifically about the metropolitan area, and then when I come back up a little bit later, I'll talk more about rural Minnesota. This map depicts by relative size of the circles, the amount of water being used by the communities in the Twin Cities area. The big red circles are Minneapolis and St. Paul, relying on the Mississippi River for water. And then the bigger green dots are all the groundwater, community water supplies. And then all of these little pink, magenta colors are distributed all throughout. Those are all the private water supplies throughout the Twin Cities area. But this is the kind of trend that we're starting to see, not everywhere, but in some parts of the state. And what this trend shows you is 60 years of record, a little more than that, in a monitoring well that we have out in the city of Orno by the Minnetonka Boat Works. What's clear from this trend is that on an annual basis, the water level in this well goes up and down. We see that in the fluctuations. But the other clear trend is the very consistent downward slope. What this tells us is that the amount of water being withdrawn from this aquifer cannot be sustained forever. We don't know when it has to be curtailed, but it cannot be sustained forever. So that's not sustainable. And by statute, that's not what we're supposed to be doing with our groundwater supplies. We're supposed to be managing for future generations. I would have you note that the lowest recording on record was last year, and the fluctuations that we're seeing on an annual basis each season seem to be getting larger. That's an indication of how much water we're putting on our lawns, frankly, during the summer months. So what does that really look like when you look at it? If you were to take a slice into an aquifer, and this is a very simplified graph, you put in a high-volume well, be it a municipal supply, irrigation system, industrial supply, whatever. That's pictured here as the deep one. You start pumping. Gradually, you pull the water down and create this cone of depression. What can happen is that can interfere with the surface water resource, such as the wetland depicted here, or it can interfere with somebody else's domestic wells. Domestic wells typically don't go as deep as some of our high-capacity wells.
Mr. Meckel, on the previous slide, we had the annual gaps, and they were growing. Would that be mainly in the metro area in greater Minnesota where there's not as much of it going to lawn use, or is it similar because of agriculture, irrigation, or is it vary well by well?
Mr. Chairman, it's a great question. Actually, we're seeing that similar kind of increased magnitude in even our agricultural areas. The places that are getting the most use, we're seeing that expansion, exaggeration, if you will, of that vertical seasonal effect. It's a great question.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The thought I had, I was wondering if the increased use of water in different industrial processes, if that has had an impact at all?
Generally, Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, generally speaking, our use of groundwater for industrial uses has been pretty flat.
Okay.
It's a great question. One of the things I failed to mention is that most of the growth in our groundwater use in this state has been due to irrigated agriculture and municipal domestic supply. Now, what makes that a little tricky to understand is that there are many municipal suppliers who will provide water to an industrial use, but we don't have the kind of data that helps us to tease that out very cleanly and very accurately. So in general, industrial use has not been increasing near as much as agricultural irrigation and domestic.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, to keep us moving along, I'm going to ask Mr. Setterholm to come up.
Thank you, Mr. Meckel. Mr. Setterholm, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, thanks for this opportunity. My charge today is to expand on the complexity of our groundwater resources. I want to be clear, I'm not here to tell you how difficult it is to do what we do, but rather just to make sure you're aware of all the different natural and cultural phenomena that affect groundwater and how we manage it. I would say that the groundwater science community in Minnesota is particularly well-organized, cooperative, and coordinated, and I'm sure they're up to the job. The geologist's perspective on groundwater is defining the container that groundwater exists within. The distribution of earth materials at the land surface and beneath it determines where water can enter the ground and become groundwater, called recharge. It also determines where water can collect and reside in significant and pumpable quantities, what we call aquifers. And it determines where water will eventually discharge back to the land surface, supporting lakes, streams, springs, and fens, and other surface water features. This is a simple cartoon cross-section of a couple of different situations common to Minnesota. On one side of the screen, we have sandy soils and sand aquifer immediately beneath the land surface. On the other side, we have very clay-rich soils and glacial till that tends to impede the flow of water. So a rain cloud comes over the top. We get precipitation, which would logically lead to recharge. We get much more recharge on the side where there is porosity to allow that and permeability to allow the recharge and porosity to store the water as compared to the clay-rich situation. So same rainfall, but a much different outcome depending on the geologic setting. Geologic complexity is certainly something we need to understand as we manage groundwater. I've taken this map of the bedrock geology of Minnesota. All the green areas are igneous and metamorphic rocks that for the most part do not supply groundwater to us. They're non-aquifer materials. So over that entire green area, perhaps two-thirds of our state, we have to rely on groundwater within the glacial sediments that overlie the bedrock. This is a cross-sectional view of the glacial materials in the Brainerd Lakes area. The yellow parts are aquifers. The green parts are non-aquifer materials. You can see it's a rather complex picture. This is because of repeated glaciations, with the original distribution being complex and then compounded by erosion with each successive glaciation. So this is one of our most challenging settings to map in to get this right. And it has impacts on things like you can look at one of these large aquifers, put a monitoring well in one place, and it may not be telling you about land use or conditions immediately above it, but things taking place a long way away from there. So it's imperative that we understand this distribution of materials in order to manage groundwater. If we then look at those places where we do have sedimentary bedrock, mostly in southeastern Minnesota, but also a little bit in northwestern, what we have is a layered sequence of sediments, many of the layers being aquifers, and they are separated by materials that are non-aquifer materials. This has a lot to do with the Twin Cities' ability to support the large population that exists here. There are a few places in the state where we have that abundance of water and those kinds of uses. Beyond geologic complexity, there's complexity in the input of water into the groundwater cycle. Our rainfall varies by a factor of 2 from southeastern Minnesota to northwestern. As I said, the amount of rainfall is not the only controller on recharge. The map on the right shows the amount of recharge, and there's a factor of 6 in the difference between the areas of least recharge and the areas of most. Here again, it's the ability of that water to get through the soil zone and the capacity of the materials beneath that to actually accept and host that groundwater. So it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. Groundwater systems also have complexity in time, and this one I think is vital for us all to understand. In this simple cross-section created by the U.S. Geological Survey, the recharge area is in the center of the picture. Rain falls there. There's an aquifer right at the land surface, and that water readily enters that aquifer and begins to travel either towards the pumped well or discharging to the stream. Because that aquifer is right at the land surface, that time of travel can be just a matter of years or days. As we look deeper on this cross-section, we cross what are called confining layers, earth materials that don't convey water readily. And if we look at the age of the water in those confined aquifers, they go up by orders of magnitude. The center aquifer, we might find water hundreds of years old. In the bottom aquifer, we might find water that's thousands of years old. And this is exactly what we see in the Twin Cities Basin. We can produce water that's 30,000 years old from some of these older wells. And this leads to a couple of complications. One is it gives us a false sense of security. If we're taking water out of the aquifer that entered the ground 30,000 years ago, obviously, it's pristine water. None of the contaminants or sources of contamination were present then. But people live at the land surface and they say, the way I'm conducting myself must be okay because my well keeps producing this nice clean water. It's a false sense of security. The other complication with this time factor inherent to groundwater management is that we could perhaps overpump some of those lower aquifers for a long, long time and not see the effects of it at the land surface. So again, we get kind of a misleading or indirect feedback that can affect our decision making. Finally, we add to that human complexity. We are at a stage now where both in numbers and in the kinds of behaviors we exhibit, humans are having a real influence on the groundwater system. This is a simple example from Long Island, New York. The vertical scale is about 30 feet, and the horizontal scale is about 60 years. The first 30 years on that graph was a community that had, everyone had their own well and everyone had their own septic system. So the water was brought into the house, used, went out to the backyard, into the septic system, and back into the aquifer. And over a couple of decades, the water quality in that unconfined aquifer started to decline. And so the decision was made, we need a sewage treatment system. And they put in all the pipes for the sewage treatment system, but they kept their original wells. So now the water was not being returned to the aquifer, but instead piped to a distant location. And the effect you can see is that fall in the water table elevation of about 20 feet, which was enough to dry up all the streams and wetland features in that community. It was a common sense solution that we need to deal with that sewage, but the outcome was perhaps not what was expected. In spite of all this complexity, I would like to suggest that there are some simple principles that will guide us as we go forward in managing groundwater. We still have to understand these systems. We still have to monitor them. We still have to pay attention. But we have to keep in mind that precipitation is our only source of water. Minnesota is a headwater state. There is no water entering Minnesota except via precipitation. So sustainability requires that we balance our use against that long-term precipitation level. We have to keep in mind that the water we put into the ground today is our water supply for tomorrow. There is no other source of water. And we need to understand the geologic framework of groundwater if we want to manage the outcomes. And that concludes my remarks, unless there are questions.
Thank you, Dr. Sedholm. Questions from the committee? No, that was very helpful. Thank you. Next, we have Glenn. Oh, Dr. Sederholm, one quick question about the last graph.
Certainly.
That was where we've done where we've completed the surveys.
Oh yeah, I just had that along in case there were questions. I run the County Geologic Atlas Program at the Geological Survey, and this is a map of where we have projects finished and where we have them underway. We're accelerating that program as best we can to make the state as quickly as we can.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Skuda. Welcome to the committee. Water quality monitoring.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Glenn Skuda, water monitoring manager with the Pollution Control Agency. And thanks for the opportunity to give you a brief overview of PCA groundwater work and a few examples of recent findings from that work. I'm going to focus on the first two bold bulleted items here on the water quality monitoring work that the PCA is undertaking, and also talk about a little bit the work we do determining groundwater surface water interactions in areas of concern. As previous speakers mentioned, groundwater and surface water are really one system, and we need to consider them together. The PCA is in the process of developing a really robust groundwater quality monitoring network. It's an opportunity that is afforded to us by the Clean Water Fund. And a couple indicators of that is a report that we produced a little over a year ago on contaminants of emerging concern in groundwater, which is really unparalleled nationally in terms of the number of sites that were evaluated and the amount of work that was done. This is about new contaminants, emerging concern chemicals. Not a lot of work has been done, and we're happy to be at the forefront of that. Also because of the work that we've been doing with our water monitoring network, both PCA in the non-agricultural parts of the state, Department of Agriculture in the agricultural parts of the state, and of course DNR with their water level monitoring across the state. We were one of the few states invited to participate in a national pilot for a potential future national groundwater monitoring network. The PCA's network as it stands right now, again in the non-ag, that is the urbanized or undeveloped parts of the state, we've got 205 wells in the network, about 80 more left to install at this point. We'll complete building out the network in calendar 2014, but we're not waiting to monitor until it's fully installed. We're monitoring as we go as we're building the baseline of groundwater quality monitoring data. One of the first products coming out of that first report came out last year in January 2012, and it's on contaminants of emergent concern that I mentioned earlier. I'll talk a little bit about that just to make sure we're on the same page. When we talk about contaminants of emerging concern, these are chemicals that are not commonly monitored, at least not in the past, and not typically regulated. Things like antibiotics, pharmaceuticals, hormones, fire retardants, personal care products. It's a long list, over 100 different chemicals that we're beginning to realize are getting into the environment, and a lot of work being done on determining what are their impacts on the environment and on people. And Department of Health will speak a little bit more about this after I speak. Briefly, in the study that we did, we looked at 40 of the wells in our network, and we actually selected the wells we thought had the most likelihood to be contaminated, kind of a worst-case scenario, so that as we're starting this work, we if there were major problems found, we could get a jump on addressing those things. The findings that we came out of that study really were that we found a very low frequency of detection of contaminants like this in our groundwater samples, and where they were found, they were at very, very low levels. This was even though we chose wells that were worst-case scenario, most likely to be contaminated. So good news that they were not found very frequently and found at very, very low levels. Bad news that they were found at all. A little more detail, we found emerging contaminants in 13 of the 40 wells that were monitored, and endocrine active compounds would be a subset of chemicals that are known to have an impact on the endocrine system, the hormonal system, were detected in 3 of the 40 wells. We did have a couple wells in the study that were chosen particularly because they were down plume from old unlined landfills, and those were the wells that had the highest level of contamination, not surprisingly. But we will continue to do further monitoring to refine this assessment because the presence of these chemicals does bear watching, and over time we'll be able to see are we getting more or less detections? Are we seeing higher or lower concentrations of these chemicals? And, in fact, we will have an update to this report coming out this summer, which uses 3 times as many wells as we were able to do in the first study. So we'll have a more extensive report coming out shortly to see what are we finding as a baseline in our groundwater. An additional report coming out later this spring within the next couple of months here is on the network as a whole, not just focused on the contaminants of emerging concern, but on groundwater quality in general. And don't like to talk too much about a report before it's finalized and published, but as a kind of a sneak peek here, just want to mention one of the most significant findings that we're seeing is elevated levels of chloride in groundwater, particularly in the Twin Cities metro area. And this is most likely due to the use of road salt. You see halide in the groundwater, which is a component of road salt that tells us that is likely the source. So that is of concern that we're seeing elevated levels. And beyond the Twin Cities, where the levels are generally the highest, even in areas where the concentrations are lower, we are seeing concentrations trending upward in other parts of the state as well. So that's a significant finding that we'll be working on additionally. Briefly, some of the work we do on groundwater-surface water interactions, studying different projects around the state. We have linked increases in groundwater extraction for both municipal use and irrigation to reductions in stream flow as well as the lowering of lake levels. PCA was a primary cooperative funder of the USGS study on altered groundwater flow and levels affecting the level of White Bear Lake, for example. Also, one of these studies identified the reduced contribution of groundwater to surface water as a stressor in the Little Rock Creek TMDL study in Benton County. A little bit on that, a few graphs here. The basic findings of that study on Little Rock Creek showed that the graph on the upper left, where we have increasing pumping over the last several years, in the upper right, we have declining level of groundwater in the aquifer, all at the same time that over the long term and the short term, we have a flat level of precipitation in that area. So the TMDL, the cleanup plan for Little Rock Creek, was just public notice in February identifying the lack of water, or the decrease in stream flow as a stressor. Additionally, just to briefly mention, we've got other water hydrology, groundwater, surface water hydrology research projects underway with U.S. Geological Survey. We're refining some of those groundwater recharge estimates that were just spoken of. We're developing what are called synthetic hydrographs, which enable us to estimate stream flow in areas where the streams are not able to be gauged to determine actual stream flow. So they're stream flow estimation tools. And then also in cooperation with National Weather Service, with the DNR, we're helping to automate rain gauges at stream gauging stations so that we have a better picture of that whole hydrologic system that previous speaker spoke of. So a lot of good work underway helping us understand what's going on with groundwater quality and, as well as quantity in the state. And I will step aside so the Department of Agriculture can speak also about their findings on groundwater quality.
Thank you, Mr. Scooter. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And before you leave, I was just going to ask you regarding the Little Rock Creek TMDL in Benton County. You spoke about an increase in pumping. What was the increase in pumping attributed to?
Irrigation for agricultural use in that watershed.
Thank you.
Mr. Scooter, one other question. When you said you sampled 40 wells, you picked the ones you thought had the most risk, obviously down from a landfill and so on. As you've been adding more wells to it, you find out your guesses were pretty good in terms of which ones were the high risk? How good is your estimation of that sort of thing? Are we learning?
Yeah. The report that we'll have out this summer, which will do 120 wells, basically 80 additional wells to those 40, will answer that question. We don't have that completed yet.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for your presentation. Next one is the Department of Agriculture, Mr. Zachman in Montgomery.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joseph Zachman. I'm a research scientist with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I want to thank you for this opportunity to address you today. I'll be giving you a very brief overview of why the department monitors groundwater for pesticide contamination and some of our results. Pesticides are a broad class of chemicals, each with unique properties designed to control insect pests, weeds, and diseases. Those same properties can pose risk to human health and the environment, and we know that some of these pesticides leach to groundwater, and we share people's concerns about their exposure through drinking water. If there are pesticides in drinking water, how high are the concentrations relative to known risk? And even if concentrations are low, what about unknown risks like exposure to pesticides in mixtures, endocrine disruption, and other concerns? So we monitor groundwater to gauge potential for potential risks from the use of pesticides. And our monitoring networks are designed primarily for agricultural pesticides. The photograph shows the typical placement of monitoring wells near the edge of an operating farm field in the highly vulnerable sand plains of central Minnesota. In the sensitive karst bedrock areas of southeastern Minnesota, we monitor in groundwater springs. MDA's monitoring efforts as a whole represent an extremely rare long-term data set that's now entering its 29th year. This map shows our current groundwater monitoring locations distributed among 10 different pesticide monitoring regions shown in the small map further to the right. The pesticide monitoring regions were developed jointly with the University of Minnesota and other state agencies, and each is characterized by unique factors like climate, cropping practices, soils, and groundwater vulnerability. In 2011, we analyzed 276 groundwater samples collected from 171 wells or sites. We recently used Clean Water Fund dollars to purchase state-of-the-art laboratory equipment that can find pesticides at lower concentrations than ever before and allows us to increase the number of pesticides and samples analyzed. Each sample is analyzed for 110 different pesticides or degradates, and that amounts to about 30,000 individual analyses annually. Approximately 40 pesticides or degradates have been detected. Most are found in fewer than 4% of all the samples that are collected. One or more of five corn herbicides can be found frequently in vulnerable aquifers, and the MDA has developed best management practices for the use of these herbicides. No pesticide concentrations are exceeding the Minnesota Department of Health drinking water risk levels. Here are some detailed results for a corn herbicide called Metolachlor, known commercially as Dual, and its degradates. These are among the most frequently detected compounds in the Central Sands groundwater. The upper graph on the left-hand side of the screen shows that median concentrations have fluctuated over the last decade and are several hundred times lower than the Department of Health's known levels of concern for drinking water, in the sub-part per billion range. The lower graph shows detection frequency. For the Metolachlor parent, which is the bottom red line on the screen, detections have been declining since the year 2000. However, the detection of degradates, the upper lines, appear to be steady or gradually rising at 40 and 70% of our samples. The Metolachlor degradates appear to persist in groundwater environment of the Central Sands, and such persistence is a concern to our monitoring program. This graph shows median concentrations of atrazine and its toxicologically significant degradates in the Central Sand Plains over the last dozen years. Although these compounds are frequently detected, concentrations have decreased significantly from a quarter of a part per billion in 2004 to very low values over the last 4 to 5 years, values so low that they're near the limits of our ability to detect them using our laboratory equipment. Here are detailed results for the corn for atrazine and its degradates in three DNR fish hatchery springs in southeastern Minnesota. Median concentrations in the upper left-hand side of the screen shows that detection frequencies are high in all the springs that we, the median concentrations appear to be in general decline, and the graph on the lower half of the screen shows that detection frequencies are high for all the springs. And for one of the degradates, we find it nearly 100% of the samples. These trends are very different from those in the Central Sand Plains. In southeast Minnesota, we can see radically different annual results based on intense spring rainfalls or worsening drought.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Zachman, is that correct? What do you attribute the decline to? I'm an old retired agronomist, Mr. Chair, so...
Are you referring to the decline in atrazine concentrations?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen?
Yes.
The decline in atrazine concentrations in Central Sands? The decline is due to a variety of factors, many of which date back to the mid-1990s when the atrazine label reduced and further restricted the total amount of atrazine that could be applied per acre. In addition, the Department of Agriculture developed best management practices that set goals, suggested restrictions on the total amount of atrazine used in the Central Sand Plains to be used, and have been engaged in a number of education and outreach campaigns with farmers to make them aware of the situation related to atrazine and groundwater contamination and the reasons to be concerned about reducing its use to the greatest extent possible to protect the resource.
So
it seems to be working.
So on Senator Rosen's point, then, in other words, went from 0.2 parts per billion to non-detect levels in a decade kind of thing, largely because of best management practices, or?
Mr. Chair, in addition to the reductions on the label, we would like to believe that our best management practices and promotion contributed to that decline as well.
Please continue, Mr. Zell.
These graphs, well, I think I went over these graphs in southeastern Minnesota and the fish hatcheries. The situation in southeastern Minnesota is quite different from Central Sands because of the way the climate and the geology interact. There are a number of uncertainties we face in our monitoring program that translate into potential groundwater risks. New pesticide-resistant crop introductions, weed or insect resistance to current pesticides can lead to new or increased pesticide use. New invasive species control sometimes requires new pesticide use. And the effect of climate change on pests and weather patterns can lead to new pesticide uses and greater runoff or leaching to groundwater. All pesticide monitoring data that we collect is reviewed annually by a multi-stakeholder committee comprised of environmental groups, state agencies, farmers, and others. Data is submitted to the Minnesota Department of Health, the Pollution Control Agency, and to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for evaluation. And finally, all data is published in reports and stored in the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's water quality database. Thank you for the opportunity to address you on these important topics.
Mr. Zuckman, thank you very much for your presentation. Mr. Montgomery from the Department of Agriculture as well.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. My name, again, for the record, is Bruce Montgomery. I'm the section manager of what's called our fertilizer non-point section at the Department of Agriculture. And I'm quite sure when Jason made the introductions about the fire hose, he was specifically talking about me. We have a number of things to go through today. I'm not sure if we'll get through them all, but similar to the House presentation, we'd be more than happy to come back or meet individually on any issues that might be of interest to you. What I'm here today to talk about is the issue of nitrates in groundwater. We're going to be throwing a lot of contaminants at you this afternoon and how we're going to deal with them. And my role at the department is to help the agricultural community and the state move forward where nitrates have significantly impacted groundwater supplies in agricultural areas. Nitrate by far is our most common contaminant that we find across the state. I'll talk about a little bit about the frequencies and where in just a few minutes. And a little bit different than what Dr. Zuckman talked about with pesticides, nitrates are somewhat unique in the fact that there's multiple origins from where this source can come from, including commercial fertilizers, manures, and so forth, as well as from our precious soil organic matter contributions as well. In terms of the concerns that we have, the primary concern is health concerns with infants. We've known this, that excess nitrogen or nitrates in groundwater supplies and drinking water supplies, to be specific, are a problem. We've known about this probably since World War II on, and through good public health and through good regulations and well codes, a lot of these health issues impacting infants has been significantly reduced. So we feel really good about that. From a farmer's perspective, I think the question that a lot of them are asking themselves is how do they minimize impacts to ground and surface waters while at the same time trying to think about things like economics and how to optimize yield potentials as well. One other thing different than Dr. Zuckman's presentation with pesticides, there is no substitutes for nitrogen. It's going to be with us for a long, long time, along with the associated problems. There's no substitutes for this very, very valuable nutrient. But fortunately, through good land-grant college research, both on state and federal levels, an enormous amount of best management practices have been developed over the last 20 to 30 years to help us with many of these challenges. I do want to point out that in some areas of Minnesota, we do have some significant loadings into groundwaters. This happens to be for the city of Park Rapids, one of their community water supplies, which shows a pretty rapid increase in nitrate concentrations over the last 20 years. And we'll talk a little bit about that in just a couple of seconds. But one of the challenges that we always have, and I think it's difficult to explain to the public, is why can't we stop nitrate contamination? With all the technology changes and so forth, will there be a time that we can literally reduce or stop nitrate contamination? And the answer is pretty straightforward. It's going to be a challenge continuously. For one thing, the nitrogen cycle, and that's what this little cartoon shows, and thank God I'm not going to try to explain that to you because we don't have all afternoon, but it is a fairly complicated system. And nitrogen can be lost in a number of different ways to the atmosphere. It can be fixed in the soil organic matter. And as the bottom arrow dictates or points out, it can be appreciable loss to groundwater once it leaches below the root zone. So I'm not going to bore you with all those details, but I think the thing to keep in mind is any nitrogen source, regardless of where it comes from, pretty much all goes through the same cycle, and we can apply basic nutrient management principles to significantly reduce but not stop nitrate contamination problems. We'd like to give you a kind of a quick overview of some of the big picture stressors that are going on in Minnesota as we deal with nitrates in groundwater. And one of the things that we frequently forget about is the importance of crop selection. These cropping systems vary drastically. And what I mean by that is crops like alfalfa, clover, a lot of our perennial systems, including our native prairies and our CRP plantings under federal programs, these all are extraordinarily conservative cropping systems in terms of their ability to retain nitrates and to scavenge for deep nitrates from whatever sources. And one of the trends that obviously we've seen as the livestock industry has changed dramatically and our cropping systems have changed pretty drastically over the last 90 years is one real simple observation is we've lost a lot of these crops that can help us manage nitrates appreciably, and that's primarily the losses of alfalfa and clover in the state, about a 50% reduction in the last 90 years. And the other flip side to that is what we've replaced them with. And obviously, our growth in our corn acres has been spectacular this year projected. This is going to be the first time we're going to exceed 9 million acres of corn in this state. At the same time, we've lost an appreciable amount of small grains, which generally is much more conservative in terms of inputs and their ability to minimize leaching losses. So some of these crops that are somewhat problematic are things like potatoes and edible beans as well as corn, and these require very skilled agronomy skills to manage them. The other part of the equation is our dependency on nitrogen fertilizer. And after World War II, as technology advanced and we were able to produce anhydrous ammonia very cost-effectively and then started adopting our cropping systems to compensate, we've seen a pretty spectacular increase in the 60s, 70s, and 80s in nitrogen use. And since the 80s, these numbers have pretty much flattened out. And the one thing I always want to mention and make sure that we acknowledge Minnesota farmers is that they continue to increase their use efficiency. So in other words, we're growing more corn with every pound of nitrogen we put into the system. There's a number of reasons for this. Obviously, our practices have changed a lot in the last 20 years. I think most growers manage their nitrogen resources quite differently, but there's also things like improved genetics, better weed control, and other factors that help us explain that. We are now basically producing about 1.4 bushels of corn for every pound of nitrogen we put into the system. So that's great in environmental news. Let me just switch, and Jason, how am I doing on time? Okay, let's just talk a little bit about water quality statewide. And our best indicator is the Department of Health's County Well Index. Jason talked about the 250,000 private wells across the state, and this cartoon just basically shows where in the state, through the County Well Index, we've found wells that exceed 3 parts per million. 10 parts per million is our drinking water standard. That's what our public water supplies have to adhere to or lower. This basically shows that in the Central Sands, as we heard before from some of our previous speakers, we've got some very sensitive geology in certain parts of the state, and there's no doubt that our nitrate levels reflect that. One of the things that, with the help of clean water money over the last few years, the agencies recognized that we needed better reporting networks and better monitoring rather than relying on the County Well Index, which is really a one-time point in time when the well is installed, to some type of a network that really helps us answer the question, are we moving ahead? Are things improving? If not, why not? And the agencies, with the help of local partners and willing landowners, have developed what we call homeowner nitrate networks. We've built a few of these in the last few years in southeast Minnesota and just recently in the Central Sands with the help of clean water dollars. This is a collaborative effort between the agencies, And as I said, the homeowners is really the key part of the success of these programs. The homeowners are responsible for taking the samples and shipping them in, and correspondence all goes through the mail. So it's a very low-cost system with the idea of having something low-cost enough that we can sustain it. And we talked about geological sensitivity and the issues of time. To do the proper monitoring, a lot of times it's in the measurements of decades. So have willing landowners that will participate. And what this cartoon shows is where all the wells were sampled in this particular network in the Central Sands in a well-designed network over coarse-textured soils. And by the way, what we're seeing here is about 5% exceed the drinking water standard in this very sensitive area. So relatively speaking, we were very pleased with those types of numbers. In Southeast, again, very problematic, a number of different issues down there. But again, to be able to tell you which direction we're going is going to take decades, but we're in good place to try to answer that question. The last thing I'm going to say about private wells is the Department of Ag and its partners have identified a number of townships that are at risk due to the percent land that's in row crop production, as well as groundwater sensitivity. We believe that there's about 280 townships that we would like to help test for nitrates, and as we move forward with clean water funding, I think we'll have the opportunity to set up a pretty aggressive sampling program to provide services to these 75,000 homeowners that live in these townships. So we look very much forward to that. I'm just going to close with just a couple of comments on public water supplies and where we stand with nitrate issues. Department of Health will be speaking right after me and can address some of these issues. But by and large, with our public water supplies, we've really got some great water in the state. And it's the agency's mission to make sure it stays that way. Less than 1% of our public drinking water wells exceed the standard, and you can see again in the distribution of where those problematic areas are. We have roughly 20 to 25 public water supplies that the agencies are working with local partners and local farmers on dealing with nitrates. The symbols with the halo around them are the areas that have elevated nitrates in agricultural communities. So we have Department of Ag staff as well as soil and water districts there doing some very meaningful work as we try to address those issues. Just one word about the Park Rapids area. There's other community water supplies that have also seen some very fast increases in nitrates. You've probably been hearing about the city of Hastings, Perham, Park Rapids, Verndale, Lincoln Pipestone. There's a wide variety of them that, for whatever reason, we've seen, and usually it's because of groundwater sensitivity, seen some fairly rapid increases. What's at stake here if we don't do anything? There's some pretty significant financial resources that need to be invested for putting in nitrate removal. In some cases, the public water supplies will have to put deeper wells or more wells to blend the water down. And our best estimates, along with the work that we've done with the University of Minnesota, suggests that with nitrates increase the public consumer cost 2 to 4x. So it's extremely important that we move forward with these educational programs. We've learned an awful lot in the last 10, 15 years working with the Department of Health and local farmers on how to address these issues, and we feel very confident that we're ready to take on some future challenges. So with that, thank you very much. And we'll answer questions at any time.
Thank you, Mr. Montgomery. Questions from the committee? I had one quick one at the beginning. You mentioned impact of nitrates on infants, and I was just curious. I have not. If you could just say two sentences about what the impacts were and how we.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer that, and I'll throw a big word out at you. But it's methemoglobinemia, or blue baby syndrome, is the problem with infants primarily below 6 months of age. It's a respiratory problem where too much nitrate can cause this respiratory problem, and basically the blood is no longer capable of carrying the oxygen it needs to the infant. We also have to be mindful that there's other sources of nitrate to the infant, including spinach and leafy vegetables and so forth. So it's an educational opportunity for the mother and the family to deal with a lot of these issues. But in terms of How many reported cases we've had, we really don't know, but we suspect it's pretty low. And again, I think education is a big one.
Thank you, and Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can you tell us what the source of the nitrates increase was in the Park Rapids area?
Sure. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'd be happy to do so. This is an area that we've identified as a pretty small recharge area. Just a couple of farms really control the fate of Park Rapids' drinking water supply. In that area, we had some irrigated specialty crops that use a great deal of nitrogen. We've got some extraordinarily willing landowners to help us approach this. And in fact, we've seen some very positive steps forward on changing some of the crop rotations, including introduction of sorghum sedan grass into the rotation to reduce leaching contributions. The RDO Corporation, who is a large potato grower in the area there, has also introduced potato varieties that use about 50% less nitrogen. And they're doing just some absolutely astonishing things in terms of management of water and nitrogen to try to address those issues.
Thank you, Mr. Montgomery. And thanks to all the witnesses for efficient presentation of a lot of information. Mr. Ellingbow from the Department of Health. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come here today and talk to you about drinking water protection. And I'd like to link some of the information that my colleagues have presented so far with some issues related to drinking water and public health, and focus primarily on groundwater and public health. Of course, contaminants in drinking water creates a potential for disease, and that can be from chemicals like nitrate or arsenic or other compounds which may promote conditions or diseases ranging from things like methemoglobinemia to cancer. We also have concerns about pathogens that can promote illnesses, including bacteria, protozoans, and viruses, and so on. And as Bruce Montgomery mentioned, the good news is that Minnesota public water supplies are doing a good job of protecting public health. And the EPA sets the Safe Drinking Water Act that regulates drinking water provided by public water supplies. And here in Minnesota, these public water supplies have a better than 99% compliance rate with meeting federal standards for contaminants in drinking water. The good news also is that we feel that the majority of private wells in Minnesota provide a safe and adequate supply of drinking water that, again, helps protect public health by having a low level of contaminants. There is some bad news. That is, there are some private water supplies that are at risk from contaminants, and our knowledge about drinking water quality related to public or rather private water supplies is limited. We also know that the number of potential contaminants in Minnesota is increasing. Most of these are unregulated when it pertains to drinking water. And we do have ongoing needs to evaluate those potential impacts on public health. Again, I'll use a couple slides that you'll have already seen, but again, wanted to bring up this one to remind us that roughly a fourth of Minnesotans receive their drinking water from public supplies that use surface waters like the Mississippi River and Lake Superior for their supply. About a quarter of our population is on private wells, and a little over half of our citizens receive their water from groundwater served out by public water supplies. Again, you've seen this slide. This includes all of the wells across Minnesota. There's over 11,000 wells used by public water supplies, including municipalities and resorts, businesses, schools in rural Minnesota, and so on. And there's also over 250,000 private wells that serve out groundwater for drinking water to Minnesotans. As you've already heard a bit about, groundwater sources across the state vary widely in quality, from those sources that require no treatment at all because of the pristine nature of that groundwater, to those that may have contaminants much like those in surface water, which is affected by our activities at the surface. And some groundwater sources are quite similar to surface water because they're affected by them. We call those groundwaters under the influence of surface water. surface water and groundwater like that require a substantial amount of treatment in order to meet the Safe Drinking Water Act requirements for contaminant levels and to make it safe for drinking. Again, contaminants can be both naturally occurring and anthropogenic, related to our activities here at the surface. They can include microbial contaminants, including bacteria, viruses, and so on, that may make their way down into groundwater supplies in a variety of ways. It can include chemicals in a wide array that I'll talk about in a minute, but including arsenic and nitrate and PFCs. Things like nitrate, of course, contribute to methemoglobinemia or blue baby syndrome. Things, arsenic over the long haul could contribute to cancer, and there's a wide range of things that may affect health that, if not controlled for in drinking water, become a concern. There can be naturally occurring radiological elements in the soil or in bedrock, including things like radium. And then I'll touch on what we call contaminants of emerging concern, which is something that we've seen a lot of attention given to over the last several years, not only in terms of environmental contaminants and their potential effects in the greater environment, but also in relation to public health. Society uses a lot of chemicals. We find that over 80-some thousand chemicals and polymers are in use here in the United States. And we find our science improving not only in terms of creating chemicals, but also in detecting them. Our laboratory equipment is getting better and better, and we're able to find things at lower levels in the water that we sample. And that's a good news and a bad news situation. Of course, our ability to detect those contaminants helps us determine where there may be a problem, but once we have that information, of course, then we have to evaluate the potential effects, whether it's in the environment or for public health. And we are also developing, we being not only the Department of Health, but more broadly across the U.S. and at the federal government, we're finding new ways to measure toxicity and find out more about the potential effects of these compounds at low doses. And sometimes the effects can be pretty subtle. We only have toxicity data on a limited number of chemicals. The Safe Drinking Water Act provides maximum contaminant levels for some over 100 contaminants. And then we also have information from elsewhere, including that developed at the Minnesota Department of Health, regarding toxicity of a variety of others. But again, if we have 80-some thousand chemicals present in the environment, we don't know whether they're present or not. If we detect them, we still need to find out more about their potential impacts, and we only have information on several hundred. Want to talk briefly about another contaminant. We have heard quite a bit about nitrates, but wanted to touch on arsenic in Minnesota groundwater, and to use this cartoon as an illustration of how concentrations may vary for contaminants across the state. Again, just an illustration, but on this map of Minnesota, you'll see the larger circles colored in red, and those show areas where we have received information from sampling of new wells that arsenic concentrations exceed 10 parts per billion, which is a drinking water standard for arsenic. And you'll see clusters of that throughout central Minnesota and on the western edge of the state, as well as here near the metro area. And that is a level of concern. Elsewhere across the state, you'll note that you don't find those red circles or the larger circles. And we're not finding those concentrations there. So I'll end with that just to say that monitoring is important, because contaminants can vary considerably across the state in their occurrence. In order to look at drinking water supplies, we require testing of those and assist with that. And as mentioned, the Safe Drinking Water Act regulates some over 100 contaminants in drinking water, and public water supplies are required to test for those. The frequency and the parameters that are tested for varies by the system depending on risk. Again, in some parts of the state, some of the systems are not at risk for some contaminants, and so it doesn't make sense to do a lot of monitoring there. Elsewhere, where there's a considerable risk or concern, we may test for some parameters frequently. Private wells, just to end on that particular note, the requirement to test for these contaminants is by law. It's by federal law. We administer that law here in Minnesota for the EPA. Private wells, those wells are only required to be tested at construction, and they're tested for arsenic, nitrate, and bacteria. After that, there's no additional testing required of the homeowners. It's up to them if they choose to test for contaminants. It's not that testing is not regulated. So a little difference between public and private requirements for testing of drinking water. We'd like to mention a bit about source water protection. In Minnesota, community public water supplies and what we call non-community public water supplies are required to develop source water protection plans to help prevent contamination of their supply. It's done by identifying and then managing potential contaminant sources within the recharge area for the well. It is required by our Minnesota rules. It's an effective and cost-efficient way to manage contaminant sources, hopefully preventing cleanup or treatment or having to drill a new well. So if you have a good supply, you want to keep it so. Private wells under law or Minnesota rules have setbacks, and so when they're constructed, they also have to manage contaminant supplies by placing those wells far enough away that we'll hope the impacts are minimal. So in summary, again, of course, drinking water is essential to growth and development here in Minnesota. We do have the potential to have an impact on both the quantity as well as the quality that can have concerns that relate to drinking water quality. Our contaminants can be both naturally occurring and anthropogenic, and this situation regarding unregulated contaminants is going to provide a challenge on into the future. But ultimately, protection of our drinking water sources is really key for public health. So with that, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Ellingbo. Questions from the committee? I had one about arsenic. Because it's very heavy spots. Is it 100% natural occurring, or is there some reason that there's these clusters?
Oh, Mr. Chair, thank you. That's a good question. The primary supply, primary issues at play here in Minnesota are naturally occurring related to our geology and our glaciation. And so those deposits that are primarily represented by the circles that you see on that map are going to be primarily linked with naturally occurring sources. That said, there are man-made sources of arsenic that can, if they make their way to groundwater, be a concern. And so arsenic, of course, is used in a variety of compounds and for a variety of uses, and if that reaches groundwater, that too could provide then a source of arsenic in the groundwater.
But the vast majority of this is going to be the naturally occurring, and just where geologically it, you see it on the map, it's going to be 90-some percent of what we're seeing there, presumably?
Yeah, without characterizing it specifically, yeah, right. The vast majority is related to geology and soil conditions, and so.
Thank you. And Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And regarding arsenic, there's inorganic and organic. So there's some arsenic that's used in chicken production to make the chickens grow faster, quicker. Is any of that possibly leaching into this, or is this the organic?
Mr. Chair and Senator, as you've noted, arsenic is actually something, it's an element that is beneficial in the right quantities, like many other chemicals are, at low concentrations and proper dosages. Most of our work would indicate that the sources of arsenic that are a problem for groundwater contamination are naturally occurring. If there were supplies that allowed arsenic used for feed or for other purposes that might allow it to leach down into groundwater, though that would be how it would occur. And whether organic or inorganic, as it made its way there, that's where this issue of identifying potential sources of groundwater contamination and managing those or locating them away from the wells becomes important from a wellhead protection standpoint.
Senator Rosen, do you have a question, a comment?
Well, it's a more of a comment, Mr. Chair. And it's just if anybody's ever been to Ojo Caliente in New Mexico, it is a natural springs, mineral waters that come out of the mountains, and there's four different pools, and you're encouraged to drink. They give you a glass, and you sit in these pools. I've done this place many times. It's lithia, iron, sodium, and arsenic. And so it's, yeah. So you sit there, and you drink the waters, and it's supposed to be...
Small quantities, I hope. Small quantities, limited dosage.
Yes.
I don't know. I'm just saying.
Senator Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the early 2000s, the federal regulation on arsenic changed from 50 parts per billion to 10 parts per billion or million. I can't remember which one it is. Are you aware of any of the scientific background that went into that decision? I'm sort of curious on if you know anything about this. I know it's back a decade.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the change took place back in 2001 mm-hmm. after a lot of work by the federal government assessing what they believed a safe level of arsenic concentration in drinking water would be. I won't claim to be an expert on having evaluated the work that they did to arrive at that number, but I will say that they put a lot of work into that assessment, and as is the norm for setting drinking water standards, they consider scientific studies and the potential impacts of those contaminants in in humans in order to arrive at those numbers. So. To summarize, I'm not an expert on how they evaluated that to move from 50 to 10, but I do know how long it takes to change a federal rule and how much work goes into the scientific evaluation because there's a significant economic impact associated with that change. It meant that public water supplies who had concentrations between 10 and 50 now had to look at installing treatment in order to achieve that lower level. And so that's at least not only are the health effects looked at when EPA changes a rule, but the economic impacts. That's why I say they put a considerable amount of effort into that evaluation. So
thank you. Thank you very much. And I want to keep moving because we have quite a number of people yet. Thank you, Mr. Ellingbo. Keith Gutelman from Met Council, managing groundwater in the metro area. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, for the record, my name is Keith Gutelman. I'm Assistant General Manager for Metropolitan Council Environmental Services. Assume this is the right.
There you go.
The 2005 legislature directed the Metropolitan Council to address water supply needs of the metropolitan area, including developing a master water supply plan and the supporting technical information and the tools to analyze water supply issues. So in response, we put together a small staff and developed some significant analytical tools. The workhorse of our analytical capability is the groundwater flow model that allows us to show the impacts on our aquifers of various rates and volumes of pumping. So with that tool, we can demonstrate what I call what-if scenarios, such as what if we increase groundwater pumping to supply a population increase? Well, what will the effect be on groundwater levels? So using those technical capabilities, we've made some interesting findings. Mainly, our current approach to water supply is not sustainable. Aquifers are being depleted. Lakes, streams, and wetlands are being damaged. And in some areas, groundwater levels have declined as much as 40 feet, roughly 1 foot a year, over the last several decades. Let me back up a moment with some background to those findings. First of all, the metro area accounts for over half of the water demand in the entire state. Now, less than a third of that is supplied from surface water sources, river water, and over two-thirds from aquifers, or groundwater. This reflects a dramatic shift over the post-World War II era. This graph shows the ratio of surface to groundwater use in the region. Surface water is in red, groundwater is in blue. Somewhere around the end of the 70s, the balance shifted from mostly surface water to mostly groundwater. The shift has become more pronounced ever since. In earlier years, most new development took place near the core cities and relied on extensions of the existing St. Paul and Minneapolis water systems. Later development moved to suburbs that were farther out and became more distant from those surface water-based systems. The easiest options then became simply drilling wells. That began putting strains on the layers of underground water, particularly the Prairie du Chien aquifer. That's the main aquifer that serves most of the metro area. These hydrographs, similar to the one that Jason had in his introductory presentation, show data from three observation wells in Hugo, New Hope, and Bloomington. They show typical seasonal ups and downs in aquifer levels, but also clearly show a steady downward trend overall. We just picked these three to illustrate the topic. There are numerous others that show the same trend, declining water levels over time. Now, that's the part you can't see. We have to rely on observations, on observation wells and water level data. But some effects you can see. This is White Bear Lake. While it's funny to see someone cutting grass with a lawnmower on what used to be lake bottom, it's no laughing matter to the thousands of recreational users, businesses, and property owners in that part of our region. And White Bear Lake is not the only lake like this. It's just the one that's gotten the most publicity so far. So these are some of the findings we've made so far, and that brings us to the natural question, what can be done about it? As I mentioned earlier, our modeling capability allows us to explore different options and see what outcomes could result. This shows what I call the business-as-usual model run. What if all the communities now use groundwater continue to supply current and future growth with groundwater by 2030, that is, drill more wells? Darker shades of blue indicate worsening depletion of aquifer levels. Red shows areas that will have reached a threshold level of 50% of available head in the aquifer. This map continues the trend to 2050. Things get even worse. So the message is clear that business as usual is not a solution. We need to take a different approach if we're to maintain a sustainable water supply for expected population growth for future generations. So we used our modeling capabilities to see what would happen if we did things differently. One of these what-if scenarios assumed that cities adjacent to existing surface water systems and along major rivers switched over to using surface water, treated river water, instead of groundwater. For this scenario, we also included the cities surrounding White Bear Lake, since that area is already starting to look at that option. What the model shows is a remarkable turnaround. Remember the two maps that showed serious groundwater depletion by 2030 and then even worse by 2050, where the darker blues and red signified the worst depletion? Here's the result of the what-if scenario where the cities that most realistically could switch to surface water did so. In this graphic, the various shades of pink indicate a reversal of depletion. In other words, groundwater would actually begin to rise again. Here, the darkest pink indicates 10 feet of recovery or more. So we can project a major improvement if we were to reverse the trend toward using mostly groundwater for future population growth and instead rebalance the ratio of surface to groundwater reliance. That leads to the questions, can the rivers handle that demand? This shows our three major rivers in the metro area with an average flow of 4.7 trillion gallons per year through the metro area. Our two major water supply systems that use river water, St. Paul Regional Water Service and the Minneapolis Water Utility, together use about 39 billion gallons for water supply, or about 2% of the available Mississippi River flow. Both also have excess capacity right now. Obviously, rebalancing such as this would not easily happen. It would require extensive engineering feasibility studies and design analyses to work out the details, not to mention the political agreements among the potential suppliers and customers of the resulting expanded systems. And most likely, one or more new surface water-based sub-regional coalitions would need to be formed. Meanwhile, we also need to focus on maintaining, enhancing the groundwater recharge capacity of our aquifers by emphasizing lower impact development practices and create and take advantage of opportunities for reuse of stormwater and wastewater. And as always, we need to continue to emphasize water conservation at the domestic, commercial, and industrial levels. All of this requires collaboration at many levels and will be very challenging, but we need to start working on this very soon. Be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Buttleman. Questions from the committee. Senator Hosman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Buttleman, the Metropolitan Council has many different jurisdictional authorities. I'm just curious, is the Met Council providing this as an advisory, or are you claiming actual jurisdictional control over water and water supplies? Because I'm not certain that you actually do have that.
We do not.
Okay. Thank you.
So this is a purely advisory function at this point.
Great. Thank you.
Evaluation and measurement. Yes. And I believe, Mr. Meckel, you're the one who's going to do the rural one because Mr. Seal was stuck in the snow.
It's hard to believe with baseball season underway, we're still talking about snow. Well, to continue the baseball analogy, I want to thank my colleagues for doing a great job of getting on base and moving runners along, and I'm going to try to do my best in the pinch hit role here that I find myself in. Jim Seal is our groundwater specialist at the DNR. He works in Southwest Metro, so I had a chance to catch up with him on the phone and get a few pertinent facts that I hope to be able to relay with these graphics, so do my best. Again, Jason Meckel, Minnesota DNR for the record. What Jim wanted to cover today was some of the challenges that we face in rural Minnesota. They're not unlike some of the challenges we face here in the Twin Cities, other than that we tend to have a little bit more of the wet industry aspect, meaning primarily agriculture and some of our other agricultural processing supplies, industries, et cetera. So I'm going to talk a little bit about each of those. We've already covered the drought, and we've already covered the groundwater provinces. I talked earlier about the fact that major crop irrigation is really on a growth in this state, and this is a map that shows current distribution of groundwater irrigation wells throughout the state. Now, if you had looked at this in 1950, there had been a couple of dots, and then gradually through the 60s and 70s, we added more. But very recently, we've seen a significant growth, about a doubling over the last decade or so, and that's put a lot of demands on the resource and, well, our ability to analyze and determine whether or not those permits can be permitted and sustainable. This just gives you a little bit of an insight. Just in the last 5-6 years, we've seen a doubling of the number of permits that we get to review and authorize. This shows you volume of water, billions of gallons that have been used and are currently being used by irrigated agriculture. I want to point out, back in 1988, I mentioned the big drought. During that period of time, we had seen at that time, record high use of groundwater. We've increased the number of operations running on groundwater, and now we're surpassing 100 million gallons. This was back in 2007 and 8. We expect that when we get the 2012 data, we're going to see that number get back up in here somewhere close to the 100 billion gallon range. One of the things that's not clear from this graph is that there are more permitted users out there, and they generally are getting better in terms of the overall amount of water that they need, efficiency with the systems that are in place today. The technology is much better than it used to be. So what I want to do now is take you to a couple of sites here. This is Granite Falls Energy on the Minnesota River. Granite Falls Energy is an ethanol plant. They produce 70 million gallons of ethanol, use about 110 million gallons of water to do that. When they initially started up, They did not have a surface water supply lined up. They came to us for a groundwater supply. They installed two wells. Those are indicated here. And they began drawing water for their production. One of the things that we told them is that this was a pretty limited aquifer. We didn't think it was going to be able to sustain their needs. And, in fact, that's exactly what we saw happen as soon as they went into production, indicated by the mouse here. Water levels in that aquifer began a very precipitous decline. They were able to get their surface water, meaning the Minnesota River supply, online. And when they did that, then it took another four years for that aquifer to actually fully recover. Now, last year, we talked about the drought. Their supply from the Minnesota River became unusable for a period of time. They switched to groundwater. Again, we saw the precipitous decline. And since that point, they're going back and forth a little bit between the surface water and groundwater, trying to make this work and reduce their impact on neighboring uses. We have set some thresholds, and this is something that's been more recent, and that is when we're going to have to modify pumping. And in this case, we've even set a threshold for when pumping must stop. Talk briefly here about rural water systems. We've talked about municipal water supplies. Rural water systems are more common only in the southwestern part of the state and up in the northwest. There's six of them currently. And I'm going to talk a bit about Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water. Lincoln Pipestone, in the very southwestern part of the state, is in a bit of a unique position because, as we talked about earlier, the water supplies here are limited. They're also not of the greatest quality. They tend to have high sulfates and iron, which makes them not very good for agricultural uses. That doesn't work well with young livestock in particular. And Lincoln Pipestone is now serving 40 different communities, 4,000 different hookups, and using about as much water as the entire city of Mankato. They also have some issues, though, in that there are calcareous fens, which are a very rare type of wetland I'll talk about, and then the endangered Topeka shiner, which is a small minnow that's only found in this part of Minnesota. One of the things I'll mention about southwestern Minnesota that's kind of complicated the situation is that we've known for a very long time that this part of the state is not water rich. And there has been a federal project called the Lewis and Clark system that's being built, that's going to 36-inch pipeline bring water from underneath the Missouri River up into South Dakota and then over into Minnesota. The federal money for that project has been inconsistently available, and the progress in getting that project online has been much slower than expected. That's been an impact to some of the communities, and I'll talk more about that. So we talk about these declining trends, so you got to do something. That's what's gone on. Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water, this is their primary, what they call the Burr well field. You see that overall declining trend, getting close to a threshold. So they started working on trying to find another water source. I don't have a graph here to show that. And we worked with them to do that. Unfortunately, we still haven't been able to identify a well, a aquifer area that they can dependably rely on. They invested $1 million trying to find one and came up empty. This is an example of where we've used thresholds. In this case, we got creative. We have what's called the summer threshold and a winter threshold. And this is for our calcareous fens. And I've got a graphic here that'll illustrate that. But essentially what we're doing is saying that during the summer months, these fens are much more dependent on and more sensitive to fluctuations in water level. So there's a threshold during the summer. But in the winter, they're not as sensitive, and so we're allowing a little bit more use during the winter months. It's just the way that we're trying to work with these communities to meet their needs, but also protect the resources. This is just an illustration of the way these calcareous fens work, and basically what you have is water recharging here, flowing down, and it comes up in these areas, and it's literally flowing up and pushing up and building this sort of mound. What makes them unique is the combination of calcium magnesium carbonate. It's a high pH, and only certain types of plants are able to survive there, and so they're fairly unique and they're rare, and we don't have very many of them in Minnesota. They are protected by statute, and we're not allowed to permit a use that's going to dewater a calcareous fen. There's a picture of the cute little Topeka shiner. One of the things that the rural water systems in southwestern Minnesota are concerned with and talk to us about is the fact that we're seeing an increase in pattern tile drainage and the increase in the irrigation. Those things are putting additional pressure on the resource, both from how is it affecting recharge, but then also how much are we pulling out of the ground. a concern for meeting their water supply needs. I think we have some examples here. Marshall, again, you're starting to see this pattern. We've got an overall declining trend. This is 20-some years worth of decline, but clearly not a sustainable pattern. So the city of Marshall began working. This is about 20 miles away. Here's Marshall down here, 20 or so miles away, where they are proposing to tap some aquifers to meet their supply needs. They're going to have to put in 28 miles of pipe, and they've estimated $13 to $14 million to get that pipe system laid to get the water back to their treatment facility and then out to their customers. Lincoln Pipestone, I mentioned earlier, these red dots, this is the area that they were looking to tap into, but unfortunately we had the calcareous fen down in here, and when they installed the monitoring system, did their aquifer test, we saw impacts on the fen, and we said, you're not going to be able to pump at that level, and they said, well, if we can't do that, we got to go out somewhere else. The community of Worthington, this is one of the communities that was intended to be hooked up to that Lewis and Clark system I talked about. The delays in that system were really problematic, and the drought hit this community hard last year. And what we've seen is the water level readings going down, approaching thresholds in previous years. Again, that's why they were looking to Lewis and Clark. And again, we saw that trend developing over the last year. This is a constructed basin that was used to, this is the recharge area. This is what they're specifically using to recharge. This is a well house. This is a well house. This is what happened during the drought. Basically, this has gone dry. They're not getting the recharge anymore. And they were dangerously close to running out of water. And they finally implemented a watering ban on lawns in October of last year. Now, that's just another shot of what it looked like. And I'm not trying to suggest here that their use of groundwater pulled the water down and dried this out. The combination of drought and the amount of use that's needed is not sustainable in that kind of a situation. So as we look at the things that we're dealing with in southwestern and in much of rural Minnesota, you know, we've got a desire for industrial growth. We have a desire for municipal supply, growing communities, and certainly around agricultural growth. The challenge is that we've got a fluctuating climate that we've never seen before in terms of the unprecedented droughts and floods all in the same year in the same state. We've got water use conflicts, wells going dry because of other users. And then we've got these natural features that we're desperately trying to protect, such as Topeka Shiners and our calcareous fens, our trout streams, our lakes. White Bear Lake was mentioned, and many others. So quite a challenge. I believe we have Jim. Where's Jim? Jim, Mr. Stark is going to come up and follow me. Any questions on that sequence?
Thank you, Mr. Meckel. We're going to try and wrap this up in 7-10 more minutes or so for confirmations, or we'll get start confirmations. By
Jim, I think you can run through it.
Time for a few more questions. Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Oh, sorry. Let me get you up there. Sorry.
Senator Marty, members of the committee, it's an honor to be here. My name is Jim Stark. I am the director of the Science Center for the U.S. Geological Survey here in Minnesota, and I want to talk to you a little bit about sustainability. To continue this analogy, it's about the ninth, and I'm here to keep us out of extra innings, and I will try to do that. So I'm going to talk about sustainability of water, where we are, in my opinion. These slides you've seen before are White Bear Lake. They've become our poster child for water sustainability. The effort to address sustainable water for our future generations is a collaborative effort, and it is an effort that's gone on for about 5 years in Minnesota. Many people have been involved in that throughout the state. Some of them are listed here. As someone who doesn't get a paycheck that says Minnesota on it, I just want to tell you that you have really knowledgeable and hardworking people within state and regional government who are working on this issue, and you ought to be proud of what they're doing. I know in my role I get to see what's going on in other states around the country, and the work that you're hearing about here today is far ahead of what most states are doing. My summary points are as follows. Minnesota has, at this time, a really unique opportunity to ensure sustainable water for the future. A great deal of work has already been done on this topic. The missing pieces are being put together. I really want to emphasize that groundwater and surface water are a single resource. We're here today to talk about groundwater, but you're going to hear me talk a little bit about streams and rivers and lakes because they are a really important part of that of that equation. And I also want to talk to you about the importance of water budgets. As critical as budgets are for fiscal matters, there is equally critical for water. And we really need to understand water demands and budgets, which are the flows through systems, as well as our water and storage. What do we mean by sustainable water? They're listed here, but in a nutshell, that means using water without causing problems for future generations. Should we worry about water sustainability? Well, we really should. We face growing demands and competition for water in this state. And sustainability, if there's one thing I want to emphasize, is that sustainability of water means more than providing water, adequate supplies of water for human needs. It's much more than that. Sustainable water management means accounting for water used as well as water to support our streams and lakes. So if you think of the light blue in this photo as a kind of a typical aquifer in the state, there's a great deal of water stored in that aquifer, a tremendous amount in our aquifers, in our streams and lakes and rivers. But only a very small part of that, just that upper surface of the blue, light blue shown on this slide, is available to us on a sustainable basis without affecting our aquifer systems, but more in particularly our streams and rivers and lakes. So it's just really the rind on that orange, if you will, the peel on the orange that we have that we can use on a sustainable basis. So like our fiscal budgets, we need to know what our revenues are, that in this case is precipitation, and what our obligations are, water needs for humans and for the environment. And we need to do this through an accounting and budgeting process. We also need to be aware of those who can't speak for us. So ecosystems then need to be a major consideration in the water sustainability discussion. Water sustainability, a couple of concepts. Again, Minnesota has a great deal of water available in storage in our lakes, our aquifers, and our rivers. However, it isn't available on a sustainable basis. Groundwater overuse becomes newsworthy when it affects our lakes and streams. White Bear Lake is a good example of that. Groundwater and surface water are interconnected resources, and we have to consider them together. And we need to preserve groundwater for our aquifers and for our streams and lakes, for our biota in our streams, for water supply, for wastewater assimilation downstream, and for recreational purposes. Again, this is a discussion about groundwater, but this is a graph of a stream. If you picture this stream, it's stream flow passing a point at a time. And you see there are periods of low. You can consider that as a year. There are periods when the flow is low. At those times, those streams are supported by groundwater. At the peaks, they're supported by runoff, like what is occurring right now. And if you think about that upper solid line as the amount of water that flows by a point in a river when that's not affected by our consumption, that's the natural flow. The dotted line is really the amount of water that we have to preserve in those streams to support downstream needs and biological needs. So that blue area, the area that's shaded in blue, is really what we have to use on a sustainable basis. And that's not a whole lot of that whole water passing by. That's one thing I think you need to consider in the discussion about using the Mississippi River as a source of water. There are times when those resources are non-sustainable as well. So sustainability, it's an important and a complex issue. Is it defined for us? Do we know what it is? Do we know if we get there? We should. There have been many groups that have considered this over about the past 5 years. These groups are listed on this slide. They've really developed a framework which provides us with what we need to do in the future. But most importantly, the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment provided us with the charge to move forward, and the University Sustainability Framework Study provided the roadmap for how to do that. What does that framework suggest? Well, it suggests a number of things, preserving clean water. The most important of those, I think, is to understand the water budgets in our hydrologic systems. We need to know the amount of water flowing through those systems because that defines the water that we have available on a sustainable basis. Many of the tools we need to move forward already exist. I've listed some of them here. I'll just talk about one, the County Geologic Atlas Series, work done by the Minnesota Geological Survey and the Department of Natural Resources, are really one of the fundamental building blocks for moving the discussion and implementing groundwater sustainability statewide. They're fundamental efforts. I think we need to supplement them a little more with some of the accounting information that we need to know about flows through these systems, but they're the fundamental building block, as well as some of the other, many of the other programs that are that function by state government and are listed here. Other steps that we need to have underway, we need to understand, have a better understanding of groundwater recharge. We need to continue to understand stream flows, both in areas where it's gauged and where it's ungauged. Those things are ongoing. We need to define sustainable resources in light of available supplies through accounting for water. Together, these steps will allow us to do a couple of things. To define the amount of water we have available in our hydrologic systems, and then from that, to understand the amount of that available water that we can use on a sustainable basis. What's left to be done? Well, I think ecologists, hydrologists, and managers really need to agree how to quantify those water budgets. And what that boils down to really is to understand that amount of blue area under that hydrograph, because that's the amount of water that we can use on a sustainable basis. We have to be able to define that number statewide. So my summary points, we really have a unique opportunity to ensure sustainable water here in Minnesota. Groundwater and surface water are one resource. We have to think of them together. The foundation is in place to ensure sustainable water. There are some missing pieces that we're working on need to be put together, but we shouldn't wait to implement a strategy that would ensure sustainable water in the future. And one of the biggest steps is really this accounting process that we have to undertake in order to maintain sustainable water for us and for our grandchildren. So I think at this point, we in the state are ready to do more than just putting out fires, and we're ready to move ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stark. Are there questions for the committee? Mr. Meckel, you're going to wrap it all up quickly.
Well, Mr. Chair, in interest of time, I mean, I could offer a few summary comments, but if we're behind schedule, okay. Well, and I think Mr. Stark just offered some of these, but, you know, I hope that the impression we've left you with is to understand that we are not managing sustainably in some places, but we are actively working to address these information gaps. You've heard about those. One that I did not specifically speak to, and that is the monitoring wells for water levels around the state. We currently have 800 wells that we use to tell us the water levels. I showed you graphics from those. We've estimated we may need as many as 7,000 to get the job done. So we've got a long way to go and close that gap. We're much farther along in our water quality monitoring, and you heard about the presentations from those folks from PCA and Ag. And we're doing much better in terms of our ability to monitor and detect those water quality concerns. We're getting a better handle on our risks. But you also, I think, have seen that market forces do play a role here that's beyond most of our control. Mr. Montgomery showed you the increase in the amount of corn acres and soybeans. Those things are a factor in all of this, and they're not something that we have a great deal of control over. And lastly, I just wanted to leave an impression on you that the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment has accelerated our ability to get the information we need, but we still need to continue to invest very strongly in this. And I'll liken this to the Minnesota Vikings. We don't have a very flashy offense here. We're kind of a ground game, 3 yards at a time. But, you know, if we stay with this, we can get the job done.
Thank you. And Senator Scalzi, had a bill. You have a bill on?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do have a bill, Senate File 1549, which would work with the DNR with some of these monitoring wells and some of the assessment devices that go with those to try to assess what's happening with the aquifers all over the state. But there would be a charge for it. And you know what? You can't use clean water money for everything. This would be paid for by the users and the monitors.
So, thank you. I want to just thank Mr. Meckel and all the presenters. I think you had a lot of information to go through, and I think it was helpful to us. Is there any other questions from members of the committee? If not, thank you very much for your time and for your presentations to all of you.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
We appreciate your coming back when we weren't able to be here when you were set up last.
It was our pleasure.
We're going to go through. We have four confirmation appointments, confirmations to deal with. First is Susan Olson and Elizabeth Wilkins to the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. Are either of them here?
They're both here.
They're both here. They're there. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Who wants to go first?
Mr. Chair, apparently I do.
Okay.
Well, I would first because I have a meeting. Oh, that's right.
Okay.
Excuse me. I'm Elizabeth Wilkins, and I have a meeting, SWCD meeting, at 4 o'clock this afternoon, so, and that's in Mora. So I probably should, considering the weather, I probably should go first.
Go ahead. Yeah.
If the committee does not mind, I would like to start out with a poem I wrote a few years ago. I thought at that time I was retiring. I was about 65 at that time. And I thought I was retiring, and I don't think I retired, but that's okay. I rather enjoy this. But the poem has to do with my feelings about the land. And I have two copies here, this is for the committee. And
we'll have somebody pick it up to distribute.
Sure.
Some. Okay. You're the first appointee who's come to us with a poem to present.
Well, at the DNR at the round table, you know, they always start out with a poem. So I would like to do that. Maybe I can set a precedent here. The land remembers. The land remembers by what we do, by what we do not do. It remembers us long after we die. Cultures, past and present, believe the land is alive. They call it Mother Earth. We call them primitive. Is it primitive to view the land as nurturing, as honored home for ancestors and descendants, to partner with other life forms so that we all prosper and grow? Our lives are short. Years and decades go quickly. We are temporary, tied to time and place. The land has no such ties. Its memory is long, not subject to forgetfulness, emotion, and selfishness. The memory of us will stand true long after we die. And I think that rather sums up with the way I feel and my obligation to the land, to Minnesotans, to the state and its resources. I would welcome any questions that you have with the information you have before me.
Okay, questions from the committee, and your resume and everything is in front of us. So, questions from members of the committee. And maybe we'll just move ahead to Ms. Olson, and then maybe we can take the two in one motion. So, Ms. Olson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a poem, so I'll just let you ask me questions.
Okay. Are there questions from any members of the committee? Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering what your definition of protect is as far as the legacy money goes.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think my definition of protect would be anything from a fee acquisition to a permanent easement or something that would keep the land protected on a permanent basis from being changed into, let's say, agricultural tilled land.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What about restoration dollars that for use in the habitat protection and restoration in the metro?
Mr. Chair, Senator, restoration is very different from protect to me. Restore is bringing something back to what it originally was, and that's not something that is necessarily limited to rural versus metro. Anything that's there can be restored to what it was originally.
Other questions from any members of the committee? Senator Scalzi.
Yeah, I just have a question, I guess, in that line, enhance. I know you've used some, I think, some kind of strong words in the past regarding rural versus metro. And I don't know what your – I come from rural Minnesota myself, and I still have property in rural Minnesota. So I understand all the different parts of Minnesota. But related to the Lessard-Sams Council – there are many places, you may not be aware of this, in the metro area that do deserve enhancement and restoration and maybe protection, except the cost is so high. But with the Lessard-Sams dollars, there are needs in the metro area where a lot of people live where it's difficult to enhance and restore without a little added money, which we provide. So I'm just wondering if you... feel that there is a need in the metro area to do a little of that work? I know the words robbing and poaching have been used in the past. So is there a need, do you believe, to enhance and restore some of the lands in the metro area?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, I do. I think that there is land throughout the entire state without boundary that needs to be protected, restored, and enhanced. I don't think it's something that is divided by metro versus rural, but there's a lot of rural Minnesota, a lot. So from a percentage where the land is, where the outdoors is, that's something that comes down to how good is the grant request and how good is the proposal and what effect is it going to have and the impact on the outdoors. I don't think that that has any difference at all between rural and metro. I think it has to do with what the project is. And you have to consider every project on its own merits.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you aware that two-thirds of the legacy money is generated in the metro?
Mr. Chair, Senator. Yes.
Further questions? So we have a motion.
So moved.
Senator Hoffman moves that Susan Olson of Austin and Elizabeth Wilkins of Mora be recommended to the full Senate for confirmation to the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. Is there a discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you both for your work on this, and safe driving up to your soil and water conservation meeting.
Thank you very much.
Senator Hurd.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that was a beautiful poem.
Thank you very much. I had that on. I was going to send it out for it to be printed. I couldn't find it on my computer. My recent computer crashed. And so I'm going to try to find it again. And if anybody else wants copies, you know, I'd be happy to distribute those once I find that disc again.
You email them to our office. We'll share them with all the members of the committee as well.
Thank you.
Oh,
you're welcome to keep. Yes, please.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Nancy Lang for appointment to the Public Utilities Commission. Welcome to the committee.
Hello.
Welcome. Did you want to make any brief statement or whatever?
Sure. Thank you, Senator Marty and members of the committee. I want to thank all of you who have taken time out to meet with me over the last couple weeks. It was an opportunity for us to talk about my background and my interest in serving on the commission, to hear questions from you, and I think as I told most everyone that I met with, even though many people have never heard of the Public Utilities Commission or understand what it does, I was motivated to seek appointment to the commission because I believe that it is an arm of the Minnesota government that has such a big impact on Minnesotans' quality of life. It sets regulatory prices for energy and telecom services. It provides access so that people have service from gas, electric, and telecom utilities. It decides where big energy projects go, which can directly affect people's backyards and properties. And it makes decisions that help continue to secure reliable, sustainable energy services. So despite its perhaps under-the-radar place in Minnesota state government for many citizens, I view it as a very important commission, and I'm honored to have been selected by Governor Dayton. So I'm open for any questions at this point.
Questions from the committee? Very good. Senator Hosman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Ms. Lang. I asked you this question. I just sort of like to have the committee hear sort of the question I asked about. You have very extensive background in environmental and ecological services and have that significant background in that. Can you sort of explain to the committee how you're going to be able to balance that with the needs of public utilities and their investors? Today we actually saw quite a few people with little flashing buttons running around here that were public utility investors, as well as to the ratepayers, how you would be able to balance your strong ecological background versus the needs of the ratepayer.
Sure. Chair Marty and Senator Osmick, when I worked for the bulk of my career at the Isaac Walton League, I worked on behalf of the Isaac Walton League members. And so I took direction from the members in terms of their interests and their objectives in achieving a cleaner and a sustainable environment. And in terms of the guidebook that I used at the Isaac Walton League, I used the league's conservation policies. And so I worked on issues that fit within the conservation policy handbook of the Isaac Walton League. I have a different constituency now. I have the state of Minnesota as a constituency to work on behalf of, which includes ratepayers, most definitely, which includes utility investors, which includes low-income people, which includes people from small towns and people from big towns, which includes companies that need access to affordable energy. And I recognize that my constituency now is very broad, and I also recognize that the policy handbook, if you will, that I'm working from now is now really the statutes and rules of Minnesota. And since I've been at the commission about 6 weeks, I've started to learn what those are in greater detail. Some of them I was familiar with, but many I'm not, and so I am learning those. And the staff has been very helpful at the commission, and what I am learning is that, you know, there are definitely guideposts and there are directions from the legislature and in rules, and that is how the commission must operate and needs to operate. And so I understand that, and I believe my work will be reflective of that.
Thank you. Further questions or discussion from the committee? Senator Hoffman moves that Nancy Lang of Minnetonka, Minnesota be recommended to the full Senate for confirmation to the Public Utilities Commission. Is there further discussion of that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations and best wishes. I know in 6 weeks you've sure had a huge learning curve, and it'll continue.
It will continue, yeah. Thank you, Senator Marty, and thanks to all members of the committee.
Next, we have Julie Goring from Moorhead for appointment to the EQB. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to tell you a bit about myself. I'm from Moorhead, grew up in Alexandria, and have always loved the outdoors, and I've been on the EQB board, and this is a reappointment, and I've watched it grow and become a very powerful, exciting group again, and I think that we're doing a lot of great things, and I'd like to continue to be a part of that.
Thank you. Are there questions from members of the committee? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What would you see as your role on the EQB?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. My role as a citizen member is just to make sure that I see it as having an opportunity to see to it that the citizens of Minnesota are being heard. And I've also worked on land and water issues in Northwest Minnesota, so I've found that I can bring some of those issues to the board and talk to some of the commissioners and make sure that all the citizens are being heard. And we do have several citizens that come in and talk to and ask questions and give their concerns to the EQB board. And so I feel the whole citizen input is really important, that we have a place for people to come and have their issues heard by policymakers and people that can do something about their concerns.
Further questions or discussion from the committee? Not Senator Hoffman. Moves that Julie Goring of Moorhead, Minnesota be recommended to the full Senate for confirmation to as a public member of the EQB. Further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. With that, I think this may be our last meeting of the session, but I won't guarantee that. But with that, this meeting's adjourned. Thank you very much.